This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. British writer Mark Haddon is the author of the novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 48 weeks and is a favorite on summer reading lists. The novel is told from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy named Christopher, who's a high-functioning autistic. Critic Michiko Kakutani writes, Mr. Haddon writes with such sympathy, such understanding of Christopher's interior life, that he makes all his obsessions and needs into a mirror of our own cravings for safety and order. This is Mark Haddon's first novel. He's written and illustrated several children's books. When his novel begins, Christopher finds his neighbor's dog lying dead, speared by a pitchfork, and Christopher wants to find out who did it. The greater mysteries he's faced with have to do with comprehending his parents and the confusing and threatening world around him. Here's a reading from early in the story.
I pulled the fork out of the dog and lifted him into my arms and hugged him. He was leaking blood from the fork holes. I like dogs. You always know what a dog is thinking. It has four moods: happy, sad, cross, and concentrating. Also, dogs are faithful and they do not tell lies because they cannot talk. I had been hugging the dog for 4 minutes when I heard screaming. I looked up and saw Mrs. Shears running towards me from the patio. She was wearing pajamas and a house coat. Her toenails were painted bright pink, and she had no shoes on. She was shouting, "What in God's name have you done to my dog?" I do not like people shouting at me. It makes me scared that they are going to hit me or touch me, and I do not know what is going to happen. "Let go of the dog," she shouted. "Let go of the damn dog, for Christ's sake." I put the dog down on the lawn and moved back 2 meters. She bent down. I thought she was going to pick the dog up herself, but she didn't. Perhaps she noticed how much blood there was and didn't want to get dirty. Instead, she started screaming again. I put my hands over my ears and closed my eyes and rolled forward till I was hunched up with my forehead pressed onto the grass. The grass was wet and cold. It was nice.
Mark, what is your main character's behavioral or cognitive problem?
If he were diagnosed, he would be diagnosed as having Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. I suppose you call it high-function autism, in that he can function on, you know, a day-to-day basis in a kind of rudimentary way. But he has a serious difficulty with life in that he really doesn't empathize with other human beings. He can't read their faces, he can't put himself in their shoes, and he can't understand anything more than the literal meaning of whatever said to him. Although I'm very careful in the book not to actually use the word Asperger's or autism.
Why not?
Because I don't want him to be labeled, and because I, as with most people who have a disability, I don't think it's necessarily the most important thing about him. He's obsessed with mathematics. That's one of the little hobbies he has. It's one of the ways he manages to pattern and organize his daily life and keep chaos at bay. And as a good friend of mine said after reading the book, a friend who is himself a mathematician, it's not a novel about a boy who has Asperger's syndrome. It's a novel about a young mathematician who has some strange behavioral problems. And I think that's right.
Because he sees the world in a very literal way and hears conversation in a very literal way, he doesn't understand jokes, he doesn't get irony, he doesn't understand human emotions, he has no real empathy for other people. What are the things that really scare him because they're so incomprehensible?
Because he can't put himself in other people's shoes, he doesn't really understand what other people are going to do. And other people are therefore extremely unpredictable. He likes his life to be safe and ordered. He's never gone farther than the end of his own road without someone to keep him company. So his life is very small and circumscribed. And it's things that threaten to wreck that pattern. It's change and difference and chaos which really terrify him.
He hates being touched. He can become violent when
indeed,
he's touched.
He does
indeed, yeah. Is that pretty typical of somebody with autism or with Asperger's syndrome?
I think it's fairly common, although a lot of people said to me, he seems like a very real character. Did you do a lot of research? And I have to say, honestly, that I did more research about the London Underground and the inside of Swindon Railway Station, where some of the novel takes place, than I did about Asperger's syndrome. I gave him kind of 9 or 10 rules that he would live his life by. And then I didn't read any more about Asperger's, because I think There is no typical person who has Asperger's syndrome, and there is large and diverse a group of people as any other group in society. And the important thing is that I did a lot of imagining, that I did a lot of putting myself into his shoes and trying to make him come alive as a human being, rather than getting him right, whatever that might mean.
Now, that's an interesting exercise for you, because what you're doing is putting yourself through the exercise of having empathy for a boy because of his problems, can't empathize with other people.
That's true, and I realized very shortly after I started writing the book that the whole thing was littered with, you know, paradoxes. On the surface, it's a very, very simple book, partly because his voice is a very, very, very simple voice. And yet you're right, it needs a lot of empathy to write a character who has no empathy. Another paradox is that he says he can't tell lies. He needs to tell the truth all the time, and he always tries to do this, and yet somehow he always gets things wrong. We read the novel over his shoulder saying, you've got this wrong, you've got that wrong, and we can see more than him. He's a very unreliable narrator. And perhaps for me, the biggest paradox of all is that you'd think someone like Christopher, who can't empathize, who can't understand anything more than literal meaning, who can't see the bigger picture, would be a really bad narrator for a novel. And yet it's a wonderful, wonderful voice to write a novel in, because it helps you avoid the pitfalls that so many novels fall into. He never explains anything. He never tries to make up the reader's mind one way or the other about anything, because he has no real idea of there being a reader out there.
Now, your main character, who is autistic, doesn't read novels. Although he's the narrator in your novel, he has a great deal of difficulty comprehending fiction. And there's a short excerpt I'd like you to read about that.
Mostly I read books about science and maths. I do not like proper novels. In proper novels, people say things like, I am veined with iron, with silver, and with streaks of common mud. I cannot contract into the firm fist which those clench who do not depend on stimulus. I found this in a book in the library in town when Mother took me into town once. What does this mean? I do not know.
Where does this quote come from? This is something that you made up to sound as obtuse as he finds metaphors as being?
Funnily enough, it's actually a quote from Virginia Woolf. It's Virginia Woolf on an off day, in the middle, I think, of The Waves, an author whom I love, actually, but who sometimes got a little too carried away.
Wow, that's really terrible. That's totally incomprehensible and terrible. But that's your idea of how all fiction reads to him.
Yes, certainly.
One of the things you had to imagine is what it would be like for Christopher to, for the first time, get on a subway by himself and go to London, where he's never been, to find his mother. So he's coming from like a suburb of London to London, mm-hmm. and it's like the Odyssey for him. So maybe you could just describe how you imagine, for instance, the subway, you know, the train looking from his point of view.
As we all know, when we visit a strange city, particularly in a foreign country, you're bombarded with information and noise and sights and sounds in these places. And for someone like Christopher, who sees everything around him and attempts to understand it all, it's completely overwhelming. Although I have to say that strange as Christopher is, this experience isn't so alien. I think one of the reasons when we read about it that we understand it is because it's an extreme version of something we've all experienced at some time or other in our lives.
What did you most empathize with about Christopher and his confusion?
Of all the parts of Christopher that I empathize with, I have to say it's not the confusion that I empathize with most, it's the mathematics. I don't know whether we've said yet, but the book is peppered with little maths questions and maths puzzles and diagrams, because he is very good at maths and obsessed with maths, and he uses it as a way of blocking out the world sometimes, in the way that many of us use crosswords or other kinds of puzzles. And that's pretty much like myself. I very nearly did mathematics at university. And even now, after I've had a month or two of novel writing, I get a yearning for numbers again and go back to working on maths for a week or so. So all the maths in the book came straight out of my head. And that is the part of Christopher that is unadulteratedly me.
That's funny, because I thought you were going to say that you often felt so confused by the world and by people's emotions and their response to you in the same way, or in a different way, than he does. But that's not it, huh?
No, I really love interacting with other people, and in that sense I'm very, very different from Christopher. But this is one of the ironies about Christopher. If we talk about Christopher as a whole, everyone talks about Asperger's syndrome and autism and talks about him as a kid with a disability. And yet every single little oddity of his behaviour I have taken from someone that I know who doesn't have that label, who is not called a disabled person, who's not labelled with Asperger's or autism. You know, he has a little habit for determining whether a day is going to be an unlucky day or a lucky day. You know, I know someone who does that. He has a habit of disliking foods that are yellow or brown. I know someone else who's like that. And someone else who can't eat foods if different food types are actually touching on their plate. And all of these people are, you know, quote, normal, unquote, people. But it's only when we put these things together that I find that I've got a portrait of a person that we call disabled.
Do you know somebody who can't comprehend jokes? Because they take everything literally? Yeah.
I know a few of those people, and I certainly know a few people. And to be honest, most of these people tend to be either scientific or academic people. People who can't really do conversation with others. People who find it very hard to listen to what the other person is saying to them because they're so worried about what they're going to say next that they're concentrating on that.
Now, I've read that you worked with people who had autism. Is that right?
That's true. After university, I spent a few years working with both children and adults with a variety of physical and mental handicaps. Even at the time, autism was a fairly kind of loose and conjectural diagnosis. And it's only now looking back that I realize that some of those people were autistic. Although I have to say, all of them were much more severely disabled than Christopher is.
What was your job?
I had a variety of jobs. My first job when I left university was to work as a live-in volunteer with a young man who was crippled with multiple sclerosis. And he needed constant attention. We two of us lived in his house and did 24 hours on, 24 hours off looking after him. And from then I moved down to London and did a series of part-time jobs helping with kids and adults, both in training centres and at home in their families.
What got you into that work?
What got me into that work was spending 3 years at Oxford University and feeling that I'd kind of eaten too much birthday cake and I needed some kind of compensation to set myself right again. I'd had 3 years of you know, hard work, but in a fairly luxurious setting in which you know, if you're a student at a prestigious university, you're kind of the center of attention and you think you're pretty important. It was really nice to go out there and do what I thought of at the time as a proper job in which I was helping other people for a change. And I really felt it restored some kind of inner balance to my life.
I'm thinking that you might have learned a lot of things about yourself by working with people with disabilities, because since some of those disabilities were cognitive, you might have had to change things about yourself in order to communicate to them in a non-threatening way.
Funnily enough, I think I've learned more about myself by being a writer. I mean, the nice thing about working with people with disabilities is that you don't think about yourself. You know, you have to be patient, and you have to think about someone else all the time.
No, but that requires thinking about yourself, particularly if you're not patient. Do you know, that would be like an immediate diagnosis there. I am not patient, therefore I have to learn how to be patient.
Well, I can be quite a patient person, so I quite enjoy doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the time when I've really started to learn about myself is the hours on end you have to spend as a writer just thinking quietly in a room on your own. And I think actually for many people that would be a harder thing than working with people with disabilities, being in your own company that much.
You know, the story is written from Christopher's point of view, but reading it you can't help wonder about how difficult it must be for Christopher's parents, because there's such a burden on them to make the world manageable for him. And to give so much of their time to creating a manageable world for him. And the parents aren't getting along. They're having problems themselves. Some of those problems are because of differences in opinion about how to deal with Christopher. So even though Christopher has no empathy, as a reader, you have to start thinking about what it must be like to be one of his parents.
That's true. And although I said earlier there will be no right depiction of someone with Asperger's because people with Asperger's are a huge and varied group, having met a lot of parents of kids with disabilities, I think there is a kind of general picture of what happens in many, many families who have a child like Christopher. And as I said to someone recently, it's probably very similar to having a child who's special in other ways as well, a child who's peculiarly gifted. Again, I've seen parents, seen families where one parent, and it's usually the mother, devotes their life to looking after this child, and that child becomes their life project, and the other parent feels pushed to one side, and as if they have no role. And I've seen many, many families break up for precisely that reason. It causes other problems as well, in that as the child grows older and wants to become adult, you find that the parent who's given their life to looking after them has a vested interest in them staying as a child, and that causes huge difficulties.
Mark, do you have a dog?
No, I don't. I have one cat, and that's all.
No, because I was thinking that the idea of a dead animal might be particularly upsetting to you.
It does, and in fact, I am a vegetarian, and on the whole, I'm very kind to animals, but I have a rather sort of dark English sense of humour. And when I wrote that first page with the dog impaled on the fork, I found it quite funny, but I found it quite funny only if I described in this flat, emotionless, toneless voice, which I really liked, and which, over the next few pages, became Christopher's voice.
What did you like about that flat, toneless voice?
What I like about it is perhaps best explained by saying, if you hear a really good comedian is funny because they don't laugh at their own jokes. And the converse is true as well. If someone's telling a very sad story, it's somehow sadder and more moving if they're not moved by it. That stops it becoming sentimental. And that's what I really liked about Christopher's voice. It's both funny because he doesn't seem to understand why it's funny, and it's more moving because he doesn't really understand why things are sad that are happening around him. And that stops the whole thing becoming sentimental.
Why don't you read that opening paragraph that Christopher narrates about the dog?
It was 7 minutes after midnight. The dog was lying on the grass in the middle of the lawn in front of Mrs. Shear's house. Its eyes were closed. It looked as if it was running on its side, the way dogs run when they think they are chasing a cat in a dream. But the dog was not running or asleep. The dog was dead. There was a garden fork sticking out of the dog. The points of the fork must have gone all the way through the dog and into the ground because the fork had not fallen over. I decided that the dog was probably killed with the fork because I could not see any other wounds in the dog, and I do not think you would stick a garden fork into a dog after it had died for some other reason, like cancer, for example, or a road accident, but I could not be certain about this.
Yeah, a part of his mind seems to be like your forensics mind, and the other part seems to be just kind of loopy and not really very intuitive at all. I guess that leads me to think, like, how do you size up a mysterious and shocking situation when you see it? Where do you look for clues, and what do you make of it? And he's both approaching it in a very logical forensics kind of way. He's also thinking strange thoughts like, I don't think you would stick a garden fork into a dog after it died for some other reason, mm-hmm. like cancer or a road accident. I mean, that's true. That's kind of inarguable, but it's a kind of strange thing to be thinking.
It's a very strange thing to be thinking, and I think that's why I found the voice so funny. Although I have to say that this seems to be another aspect of Christopher's voice, because he doesn't try to push the reader one way or the other, trying to make them feel this or that about what he's said or what he's seen. Some people have read the book and wept their whole way through it and found the whole thing sad and the ending sad. And other people I've talked to have found it very funny the whole way through. So that people have completely different reactions to the same book.
Mark Hedden, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.